okay with us for the current number of weeks. As I've indicated, the minister has brought in the whole super team. First, the DG, Mr. Kanyako.
This was not planned earlier.
Okay. On the list is also Mr. Kubernu, who also on the same flight. Look, I'm not going to call these names until you hear them speak when their time comes. We're just going to immediately get onto your submission and then allow for members to engage with yourselves. Thank you, Minister. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me firstly express appreciation to the committee, and then secondly, just make the point that frequently confuses many people. The Treasury's interest is in vote 7. Though the Revenue Service is... Sorry? 8. Oh, it's 7. It is 7. Well, I'm sorry that the DG argues with me like that, Chair, but you know. When the Revenue Service comes in tomorrow, even though they are a transfer from the Treasury, they come here without the DG. And when StatsSA comes here on Friday, they come without the DG. We are hoping that the Deputy Minister will be present for this discussion. I think that in the current milieu, it's necessary to look at the work of the Treasury and try and understand this work quite differently before we even go into the strat plan itself or look at the E&E and look at vote 7 there. It's necessary to look at this issue quite differently, Chair. And the key issues that we have to focus on is whether the National Treasury is equipped to deal with a series of issues. And in order to understand that, it's then necessary to take a step back and try and understand what the role is of the Treasury within the context of government. And it is a role that is about using the skills and techniques of forecasting, the ability to try and anticipate the challenges that lie ahead, the ability to ensure that the resources are adequately provided for government to be able to do its work. And then, in the current period, very importantly, a role to ensure that we can adequately regulate financial services, that we can provide through bond markets for the management of government's liabilities, that we have rules to provide for government's assets, and also then a series of systemic issues that relate to the integrated financial management system, the procurement systems, and all of the systemic issues, and then the responsibility to ensure that the books are written up and can be presented to the auditors of government. So it's essentially an internal function that's focused on providing, which is informed by foresight. And the first slide today deals with issues that are in the main exogenous that impact then on the ability of Treasury to be able to perform its functions. And you know, we don't use this often, but we've taken to calling this the three F words. And the first of those is the financial market turmoil. Um, last year, the discussion, certainly at this time of year, there were already indications of what was called the subprime crisis. That nomenclature remained for some time. It was clear that it would never be a phenomenon confined to poor borrowers who had no income, no jobs, no assets, but that it would spread because you couldn't entirely cauterize that as a part of the mortgage market. Indeed, it has spread. There is a very interesting study by Professor Noriel Rubini at the New York University who suggests that over the period, the fallout from or within the U.S. mortgage market is likely to impact on 10 to 15 million families. Would in all probability add up to about $1 trillion, but it's not an immediate issue. Trying to pin a number on the immediate fallout from the market has been quite difficult, because whilst we could see from time to time what the write-downs were of individual banks, the systemic impact of this fallout that arises from exuberance is something that we needed to understand differently. In April, at the time of the spring meeting, the IMF released a report that suggests that the world should anticipate an impact that measures something in the order of $967 billion. It sounds like $1 trillion. And the question that we would be confronted with is, what happens when $1 trillion have to be written down? Where is the risk aversion going to come from, and how do you keep financial markets liquid and active? And whilst there's one way of looking at the entire issue, and you can say, well, we've looked at the South African banks, and apart from one bank that had some exposure to a mortgage originator in the United Kingdom, there's no immediate impact of the subprime crisis. So technically that would be correct, but I think there's another side to it that does impact, and that is, firstly, that the interbank market has collapsed because banks need to borrow from each other, and the interbank market has always been premised on the existence of a trust between equals. That trust is now broken down, and in the absence of an interbank market, keeping financial markets liquid is a huge global problem. And the second feature that arises is that the only debate that took place in Washington a few weeks ago, Chair, was whether what you have is a credit squeeze or a credit crunch. Now, how much time do we have to debate the difference between a crunch and a squeeze? But what is not the subject of debate is that access to capital is going to be exceedingly tight. And the way in which the market speaks to this is by very sudden moves in the rates at which countries, companies, or individuals can borrow. Last year, we could borrow at about 65 basis points above U.S. Treasuries for long-dated stock. It moved from there. When a measure was done recently, it had tightened to 300 basis points. Not because of anything we've done wrong, but if you need to go back to the market and the market conditions have changed, then clearly there's a price to pay. Now it's tightened a bit to something in the order of 220 to 230, but that's the reality of what there is. And if you then have to finance huge deficits and stuff like that, it becomes exceedingly difficult, exceedingly expensive. But it also then puts a drain on future resources, because you are then imposing a tax on the future. It's understanding this and understanding the ability to anticipate these exogenous shocks, and this clearly would be one of them. Now, you might want to have a debate today, Chair, unresolved debate about whether it's safe to carry a fiscal surplus. But you can't have that debate without trying to understand what is happening and the powers of anticipation about financial markets. The second set of issues, also exogenous shocks, is the global food prices. Now, I know that we feel very done by. Deputy DG here was participating in a radio debate this morning on VAT on foodstuffs. We feel very hard done by. But we should feel even harder done by, because South Africa doesn't make the list of the 50 countries worst affected by food price shocks. It's a truly global issue. You can look at the big crops. You can look at about a third of the U.S. corn going into biofuels, bioethanol, providing just under 10% of the fuel needs of the United States. All of that is subsidized, and it's a no-brainer. You can then grow corn and know that you're going to be paid. But now that there's a change in the market, and this happens in an environment where you know we're fortunate in that we've had a very good season for maize in this country, but the prices are going to change globally. The second feature is that there have been crops where you've had some rainfall patterns change. Australia now only produces 2% of the rice that they did 6 years ago. People prefer to grow Chardonnay, you know, over rice, because it requires less water. And there's a greater demand for it from people who have money, unlike rice consumers. So these things have happened. As grain crops have increased in price, you know, at the end of the day, what is a cow, Chair? A cow is some maize or soybeans with a bit of value addition. That's all a cow is. And some people eat the maize or the soybeans, and other people want the cow. But you know, it's not a very efficient converter of maize into protein either. But there you have it, and that's what we eat. And these price changes are going to be there, and it's got nothing to do with anything that we have done wrongly. And then the oil prices, when I looked this morning, it was $125.05 a barrel of crude. And clearly it's a worrying feature that's going to be there. And it's going to be there for as long as you have clearly the refining constraint that we're living through. I'm saying, Chair, honorable members, it's understanding that this is the world. You know, we ask Mr. Khadebe, the Deputy DG, and his team to manage the portfolio of government debt. And they must have an input in understanding what the macroeconomic risks are going for. If they don't, if we send them into the storms of financial turmoil without adequate protection, then their ability to perform on interest rates that are tolerable is an impossible task that we set. Similarly, on the tax policy issues, and we might want to come back to this, because you know there's been very detailed investigation. We aren't sitting around waiting for these issues. We've been doing detailed analysis in terms of zero rating, and I think members of been in this committee for longer would know the experience we spoke of when we zero-rated paraffin a few years ago. But you can, I mean, we now have analysis product by product, how much benefit accrues to the consumer as to the producer, and why. And so, you know, it's not just a churlishness. I'm saying that we need to engage with the available research about this issue. So, Chair, these factors impact very directly. Before you look at South Africa, consider the fact that China has a surplus on their trade account with the United States, something in the order of $170 billion. Now, if the U.S. goes into recession and China can't manufacture, then there are going to be upstream shocks in China. People are going to be put out of work. They can't manufacture for markets that don't exist. And if they're not manufacturing, then it will, in time to come, have an impact on the commodity prices, and those commodity prices will have an impact on our export earnings. The issue of risk aversion is something I spoke of earlier. The credit availability will impact on household balance sheets. How much, what measures we can use, how we deal with the price instability that arises from inflation. All of these are big issues, and then as the slide says, there's a bumpy ride. There's going to be turbulence on exchange rate markets. We'll come to inflation in a moment, the purchasing power of poor households. I think again we had the luck of timing because Stat SA, not influenced by the Treasury or anybody else, released the results of the income and expenditure survey. In fact, it was just a few weeks ago, and did a presentation to this committee. And in that, I think it allowed us to understand the differences between honorable members, and I know that we are all very upset with the Motsoeneke Commission and about our salaries, but you know, we still only spend 9% of our income or thereabouts on food, whereas with decile one, it is in the order of 32%, and that's a big range. You've got to understand the impact. The issues, and I've been parodied for saying this, but clearly we need to examine how we can increase the output in agriculture. There's too much land in South Africa that lies fallow, and I don't mean that you should convert your back garden at Acacia Park on the chairperson into a farm. But there's a lot of land in rural areas, and we need to think about this issue differently. The oil price is clearly a big issue, first round effect. And I think the fourth sub-bullet there on slide three would be the stuff of the energy summit that sat on Friday to deal with it. The slide that now is familiar is one that was shown the day after the budget, trying to understand transport, food, and then second round effects, so that we have some anticipation of what information the Monetary Policy Committee has, and that which informs our decision making generally is contained in this slide. And part of the worrying features, I think, are changes in the food prices that you're seeing now, and colleagues will remember this peak of the year, which was the maize price peak. And it's come off, and you can see the impact on inflation, and the interrelationship between food prices and general inflation is something we understand very well. The difference between that peak in red and the gray bar there would indicate that you weren't seeing that work through in the transport costs in the same way as $125.05 a barrel works through on transport costs over there, and this is the worrying picture. We try and work out what's happening out there. It's clearly not a happy picture. You know, I think we lifted by being in the right region this time. And the forecast for sub-Saharan Africa is 6.6%. There's a bit of a mirror image of disaggregate between the oil exporters and the oil importers. And there's an enormous burden that's borne by countries that are both oil importers and food importers. They might be commodity rich in other respects, but oil and food, very significant issue. That weighs heavily in bringing that growth rate down to 6.6, but 3.7 from 4.9 for the global economy this year. It's early yet. Interesting debate. I mean, I think that there's a sense of belief that Bear Stearns was in many ways a turning point. But I think there's also a sense that that might be only the beginning of the end of the cycle, but the beginning and not the end of the beginning of the cycle, if you wish. So I'm saying it's a moot point, but it's fortunate that we discussed this issue while it is topical. As it is in the world, the issue of a mild recession, what mild is, we don't know, but I think there's a very strong sense that there's going to be a measure of contraction in quarters one and two, certainly in the United States. EU is still strong, and then this issue of food prices in the emerging markets. Now, Chair, that's the picture. We could spend a lot of time talking about the picture, but I think you need to understand the picture and understand the extent to which a lot of what's happening in that picture happens to us, not because of us. It's what economists choose exogenous factors. They're there and they're important. And you can't take policy decisions as though those issues don't bear down on you, because that's the environment within which you operate. And you ignore them. You ignore them at your peril. And sometimes in these moments of extreme populism, we say, ignore the world. You know, we're okay. We can batten down the hatches and carry on. But clearly it's not the way we can run a sound treasury. And one of the big issues that does confront us is the issue on 5-6. Not because we like it, or not because we belong to people who have a hobby called sadomonetarism or anything like that, but the Constitution compels us to have an arrangement for price stability. And there was an intense debate. I mean, we've been through this matter in this committee on countless occasions before, where in the publications of the Reserve Bank in the 90s, they described their monetary policy as eclectic. And one of the fallouts of that eclecticism was a net open forward position that built up to $25 billion. Important that we see that as negative reserves. And the only way to make that good is by taking from the other side, from the Treasury, from the expenditure side. And if you take from the expenditure side, then you can't provide all of the services and everything else that you want to deal with it. And clearly our methods of doing it was not just to vote this narrowly. There was the issuance of debt and sterilization processes. But it does mean taking from the expenditure side. And every time people say target the exchange rate, I'm sorry. For as long as I'm still responsible for issues, I'm going to ask people in the Treasury to look at this matter technically, Chair, and to ask about those experiences. And if we don't want that, and if we try and understand what is happening, and if we can, as we are doing now, improve on the quality of information from a range of sources, so clearly we can look at exchange rate movement, we can try and understand credit extension, we can try and understand money supply, we'll try and understand all of that, but the key issues that we then have to understand is what decisions are going to be in the best interest to provide the constitutional remit, which is a remit of price stability. And that's where we come to inflation targeting. Now, it's a very difficult reality as set out in that first bullet. We've set a target of 3 to 6%. In doing so, some people said, oh, it's too loose. You've got to set a point. But we argued that our systems in South Africa as a young democracy might not be as mature as all of the systems in the way in which they interact. You know, there are parts of this economy that you still need to tighten using a bobby and spanner, you know. In other economies, you can do it with a watchmaker's screwdriver. There are differences. And the maturity of systems and institutions, I think, are very important in that regard. This inflation is a worldwide phenomenon. We're saying that in the present, it's going to remain above that target of 3 to 6%. Until next year. Now, if you want the measure to work, it's also important to understand that you can't use instruments to try and impact over that which you have no control. If you try and use interest rate increases to bring down the price of oil or the oil consumption in a country that has a geography such as we have, it'll be the wrong instrument. Ditto for food prices, but you have to look at all of the other prices. You have to look at the behavior of South Africans, and notwithstanding interest rate increases that are there, that ought to bite. I mean, we still live like there's no tomorrow, Chair. The bulk of us. So, the third bullet is about that necessary adjustment, and the fact that we shouldn't then ask of the Reserve Bank to take full responsibility for this, in terms of their responsibility for price stability. But there has to be some fiscal adjustment. And the issues of wage adjustments will have to take account of that higher cost of living. But in saying so, I think that we would also not be true to the responsibilities we have if we didn't urge moderation. Because there's going to be a price of a wealth effect. It's going to be a huge price. It's going to be a price that arises from permanent damage to an enormous battle that we've undertaken to bring. Just go back one more. You see, Chair, our battle has been, if you went back even further, I mean, South Africans got used to inflation of around the 15% mark. And this was the system starting to work for us. Now it's kicking out. And I think it would be foolhardy to give up the fruits of what has been a very courageous struggle waged by the Reserve Bank to bring price stability, because we know that price stability allows for good decision making, not just with investors, but it also locks in the gains of working families. And you don't want erosion of the hard-won gains of an industrial relations environment. That's a policy. That's a policy environment we're dealing in. That is where my responsibilities in this presentation will end, Chair. Because now we say to DG Haneahu and his team, now what do you do about that? Now that you understand it, you agree at this stuff, what do you do about it? And that's what the rest of the presentation is about. Thank you.
Are you saying, Minister, yours is just to understand the environment?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Sanya.
Thanks, Chair and Honorable members of the committee. So that makes my job easier. I'll pull it, I'll shift and. They have normally accused me of speaking too loud.
It's a Malachi problem.
That is the policy environment, and within that policy environment, we had set ourselves measurable objectives per program, and the overriding aim of the Treasury is to promote economic development, good governance, social progress, and rising living standards through accountable, economic, equitable, and sustainable management of public finances. We do so through the advancing economic growth and income distribution, preparation of a sound and sustainable national budget, and equitable division of resources. We strive to equitably and efficiently raise fiscal revenue while enhancing efficiency and competitiveness of the South African economy. We soundly manage government's financial assets and liabilities and promote transparency and enforce effective financial management. The operational and policy responsibilities of the Treasury through number of divisions, economic and fiscal policy, public finance and budget management, asset and liability management, fiscal management systems, financial management systems, and financial accounting and reporting. We have translated these responsibilities into programs, and each one of those programs have measurable objectives. The key focus areas for the period 2008 to 2011, we start with Program 2, which is Budget Management and Budget Coordination, have to do with maintaining a sound fiscal stance to support growth and development in the context of global economic turbulence. The budget process improvements focused on effective service delivery and better value for money, including improving the quality of performance information published in the budget consistently until they are rendered auditable. Enhancing the financial management oversight over public entities and strengthening capital expenditure planning, evaluation methods, and capacity. There is a lot of detail that is in the output tables which are in the strategic plan, but for ease of discussion, we have also included them as annexures to this presentation. We will not go through all of them here. Central priorities in terms of the budget coordination focus on investment in the built environment, road, rail, and transport infrastructure, information systems in integrated justice sector reform program, asset management in government buildings, maintenance and accommodation, continued work towards development of a contributory social security system, and education, health, and skills development. You see from these sectoral priorities that the bulk of this work takes place in other government departments, and our task is to ensure that there is value for money in this program and make sure that they are consistent with overall government programs. The second sub area of program two is the intergovernmental relations area, where the focus is on fostering further equity in the division of nationally raised revenues and intergovernmental transfers, promotion of transparency through timely publication of provincial and local government budget and expenditure reports, continued efforts to increase coverage and accuracy of local government reports, to strengthen financial management, governance, accountability and capacity in local government, and the rollout of the infrastructure delivery improvement program in key provincial departments involved in infrastructure. And later on, when we talk about the IDP, you would see this is a program that now is in full stream and is basically now rolled out in almost all of the provinces. And building on the experiences of IDIP, Sianza Manje was launched, and we continue to support the Sianza Manje initiative to unlock service delivery and infrastructure at a local government level. Program three is the area of assets and liability management. And here the focus is on active management of debt with a view to reducing debt service costs subject to acceptable limits. The sound forecasting and prudent management of government cash flows to ensure that the right amounts of cash are available in the right quantities at the right time. Policy focus on managing the external vulnerability and the impact that the external factors have on our debt portfolio, increasing the operational efficiency of SOEs, state-owned enterprises, through improved financial oversight. This is still a key area of risks to the fiscus. The rollout of a treasury management back office system to make sure that we are able to track all the debt and the payments and try and extract from the value for money from active management of our debt. Programs 4 and 5 would cover the area of specialist services and the Office of the Accountant General. Here the focus is on coordination and implementation of the Integrated Financial Management System, IFMS. We are now moving into phase three of the Integrated Financial Management System. The rollout of strategic sourcing principles, basically identifying key transversal contracts and making sure that we get value for money from that. Compliance with the standards of generally recognized accounting practice in preparation of a timely and accurately consolidated financial statements. The members would be aware that the Auditor General still classifies this consolidated financial information. The idea here is to step that gear to make sure that they eventually become a consolidated financial statement rather than just information. The support of all spheres of government and public entities on compliance with the applicable standards and prescripts. And lastly, a greater emphasis on governance in developmental operations through strengthened risk management and internal audit functions. Program 6 is the area of economic policy and international financial relations. Here the focus has been on reforming the system of retirement funding. This is done jointly with program 2 because there are two legs, the broader social security system and also directly the private retirement provision system, and make sure that those fall into one coherent approach by government. Enhancing the accessibility to financial services, making sure that affordable products are available to the majority of South Africans. In the tax area, the focus is on replacing the secondary tax on companies with a dividend withholding tax, and the finalization of the mining royalty bill and the diamond export levy bill. On the international front, a focus on Africa's economic development and regional integration in SADC, a strengthened economic policy and forecasting, covering microeconomic analysis, the type of that the minister was referring to, a continued support to the G20 policy. Since we were chairing the G20 last year, we are continuing to be in the troika of the G20 this year, ensuring that some of those policy areas that we worked on as the chair of the G20 are carried through. This will be the last a year that we have got a leadership role in the G20 this year, because it is the last year of our troika. And continuing the research on growth, and members here would also be aware of the publication of the work of the international panel. That research was being coordinated from this program. A further development of research capacity to address key economic focal areas such as growth, employment, banking, and taxation. Now, that is the core of the policy work of the Treasury. It covers economic and fiscal policy, public finance and budget management, asset and liability management, financial management systems, and financial accounting and financial reporting. The programs that follow are mainly transfer programs. The provincial and local transfers program, that is where the equitable share takes place, and some of the conditional grants. Program 8 covers the post-retirement medical benefits, civil and military pensions. We also have international financial transfers, which would have to do with our obligations to the World Bank, to the African Development Bank, the transfers to the South African Revenue Services, which account separately, transfers to the Secret Services, to the Development Bank for the funding of Senza Manje, and lastly to the Financial Intelligence Center, which also accounts separately. We also have public entities and other financial responsibilities, which are stated there. I do not have to go through those. All of those come through to the committee to account in their own name and right. The key focus areas for the 2008 and 2009, starting here with the Program 1. Program 1 basically is a support program for the entire treasury, and provides strategic leadership. The minister's office and the DG's office are located in that program. To biannual review and update of the corporate services policies, procedures, and standards, make sure that they meet the challenges of the treasury. Implementation of integrated client relationship management strategy. Again, the clients here are all internally servicing the internal divisions of the treasury, and making sure that we have got an adequate, safe, and secure facilities for the treasury. And lastly, to enhance and expand the knowledge management culture within the treasury. The summary of the expenditure, this is the operational budget of the treasury, and it's broken per program. That is what was on budget for the 2007-2008 fiscal year. We are going to have to come in later in the year when we table the annual report to see say how we had performed in that fiscal year. This is the preliminary outcome of that operational budget, and this is the budget for the 2008-2009 fiscal year. This is the transfer budget of the treasury. By far the biggest is the transfers for provincial and local government transfers, and then civil and military pensions, contributions to funds and other benefits, and lastly the other fiscal fiscal transfers. Personal plan now this year going to be done, and the previous financial year we filled 179 vacant posts. We also had 132 people leaving the treasury, either joining other government departments or moving on to the private sector and some public entities. The net effect of that is that the total vacancies have decreased from 133 to 99 between the 31st of March 2007 and the 31st of March 2008. This is for the reductions in the thing. All posts that were vacant and not funded were frozen. We assigned dedicated resources, both in the front office of HR, to the project to make sure that positions are filled, and we regularly monitor and track the progress in the filling of positions. And also, there is an improved relationship between HR and the line function departments to make sure that the positions are filled adequately. How does the staff profile of the treasury look like? That is the gender profile: is 39% female and 61% male.
It's not reflected in the house this morning.
and the employees below below management, there are 60% female and 40% male. In terms of race, 65% black and 35% white, and below SMS, 75% black and 25% white. This is the present organizational structure of the treasury. this is where the work is done, and those are the overheads. We have gone through an organizational review, and we've come with an organizational design that is geared to improve organization, improve coordination, and greater transparency in a larger organization. And we have created dedicated technical and management advisory unit for government operations. The treasury is constantly required to assist other government departments, whether it is home affairs the South African Social Security Agency and so forth. And we had felt that we needed to organize ourselves to take cognizance of that. Those are the outputs per program. That is what is attached in the annexures. I'm not going to go through that, Chair, and thank you very much for your indulgence.
Yeah, thank you. As indicated, this stuff is actually in the report itself, and in the strat plan. I would imagine members would... it's useful that you have them attached here so that members don't keep on paging back. But there we have it, members. I will now open this for questions. Minister, the DG mentioned in his presentation in one line the issue of the recently released report by the so-called Harvard Group. That's precisely what I wanted to clarify, because you know it's called the Harvard Group, and I see it's not everybody on that group that is from Harvard. So, but perhaps it would be useful for this committee, for the ministry, just to inform us as to what the status of that report is, because it has tended to be regarded as a
a gospel. It's referred to in a number of times, and I know its work is not complete as yet. Maybe it would be useful just to know what the status of the report is, and so that whenever we engage and we refer to it, we don't refer to it as, you know, this one and only gospel thing that is there for all of us to, you know. Yeah. And then I will open this for our discussion.
Thank you very much, Chair. I mean, as it happens, I've also had the privilege of involvement in a commission set up globally that looked at the issues of growth and development around the world, trying to make some sense of available information. And as it happened, that report is being released tomorrow. It's a very exciting report. But one of the issues that would be raised there is that these are general observations that would matter to policymakers, heads of government or heads of state everywhere. Whether you are in China, in Korea, in Burkina Faso, in Zimbabwe, or South Africa, based on available evidence. But every country has to deal with the detail of its peculiar circumstances by thoroughgoing analysis. And I think it's important to understand that what the international panel did was to undertake pretty thoroughgoing analysis of the economic development prospects in South Africa. Now, at some point, we've been grappling with growth, and I'm sure members here would recall that we were concerned about the fact that South Africa has found itself in a kind of steady state equilibrium of give or take 3-3.5% for too long. And the question that we've grappled with is how you can lift growth, because you need to lift growth in order to create more employment and raise the quality of life of more people sooner. And after the first conference was convened in the Treasury, we then opted to try and assemble a group of economists. And you know, one of the participants in that first conference was Professor Ricardo Hausmann, who is at the Harvard Institute for International Development, himself a former Minister of Finance and Planning in Venezuela. And the team was assembled from universities, primarily in the north, but We tried as far as possible to include a number of South African academics in the work, so that we could get some balanced views. And the team and its work, had four or five intensive sessions in South Africa, at which occasion they would have sort of academic workshops, seminars, but also on each occasion spent time with various government departments, and then at least one occasion each time they were here as a group with cabinet. And the work has now been concluded, and the publication's released as a set of 21 different papers. 20 papers, 21 recommendations. Now these are recommendations that we would have to engage with, and of course I needn't tell you, Chair, that these things are received differently by different parts of government. And I don't think we would ever take the view that these are sort of the tablets come down from the mount now with Moses. These are issues we have to engage with. The recommendations cover a fairly wide pan of issues on the fiscal and monetary policy issues, for instance. I mean, you know, the reality that you run a current account deficit is noted, but then very strongly you can't run a fiscal deficit as well. Some of these issues we've taken account of. The structural balance that we introduced in the MTBPS last year was one of the issues, so that you don't punish yourself for cyclical revenues that may be built in. But there's a recommendation that we should in fact run that government should be contributing more to economic growth by contributing more to savings by running a higher fiscal surplus. It's a big issue that we have to engage with. And on monetary policy, for instance, a recommendation that you maintain inflation targeting, but you build in some flexibility to take account of some exchange rate management. It's a very difficult issue. But in some respects, easier than some of the other issues that they've raised. One of the proposals is in respect of labor markets, and very importantly, they're trying to suggest that we aren't doing enough to smooth the passage from school to work. And if the bulk, or if too many young people who leave school, 12 years or so of schooling, find it impossible to find employment in a short space of time, there's a huge risk of a social problem. And so you need to give people a stake, and we need to be more determined about the policy inputs and training opportunities for people. So they've thought of the scheme. I mean, it has to be tested in reality, with every sort of 18-year-old being entitled to an amount of money. Top of my head, I mean, call it 50,000 rand. Which is your training money. It's contained in a card, smart, magnetized strip or something. And whilst you're training, that money is then used up. And if after you've used up the 50,000 rand, I mean, you should be able to do something. And that transition can then be facilitated because, you know, too many employers see it as a kind of negative tax if you say there are young people, take them in, train them and afford them opportunities. Because I think colleagues would know that the CETAs are largely designed to deal with people already in employment. Now that might be a very controversial proposal, but I think we have to be thinking. We have to engage with the reality of young people who can't find employment. If we don't deal with that, and sometimes even start with a proposal that might at first blush appear quite outlandish, it's very hard to deal with it. If you only deal with those who are already inside the system and try and lock in and protect everything, I think that there are too many people who remain outside. And those outsiders present some of the risks that country, unfortunately, might be living through at the moment. So we have to deal with these kinds of issues. There's a different proposal that they make in respect of the CETAs. They argue, for instance, that if you run a large power company, Eskom, the skills that you have ought to have should have are multidisciplinary. You need IT people to run the system, run the grid. You need outstanding IT. You need people who understand construction. You need people who have very strong electrical, high voltage electrical skills. You need a range of different people. Now, if you only then myopically go into one sector, you lose out on all of the others. Multidisciplinary companies need multidisciplinary skills, and the concentration of skills are unlikely to be in a single sector. So you should be able to then choose. So I'm saying, Chair, you can go through 21 recommendations. A number of them kind of shake you at the roots and say, what are you doing about these things? Is this a real problem? Is it not a real problem? But you've got to receive them as recommendations and not as cast in stone. There's one very important caveat that we need to put on the table and ensure that it's there at all times. Economic policy is about doing some good things, some interesting things, but it's also about taking some tough decisions. In broad approach terms, the methodology that's been developed at the HIID, the Harvard International Institute for International Development, is one where they try and deal with a binding constraint. You try and understand what constrains you from growing further. And then you try and deal with the constraints. And that's how you create the opportunity. There's a second element to it, and they say that policy change requires a fair measure of experimentation. They use Deng Xiaoping's analogy, you cross the river by feeding the stones with your feet. There's no bridge. You want to get across the river, you've got to feel the stones. Don't feel the stones, you're just going to drown. But feeling the stones is that process of experimentation. So it's very rich. But let me conclude with the last analogy that is also told by the authors. They say, look, think about driving on a road. At the moment, you're driving your car at 120 kilometers an hour. But the road is only designed for safe speeds of 90. So you might have the skill to just stay there. But it would be much better to change the road. Change the curves of the road, change the both horizontal and vertical. And allow yourself to drive as though on Autobahn in Germany. And if you can go faster, then go faster. But going fast on a road that's poorly designed and not designed to carry you at the speeds that you're going is going to result in a crash. Policymakers want to take the boom and bust out of the outcomes and continually improve on the quality of life of people. So that's how those proposals are there. We just hope, Chair, that this information would be available to all South Africans. That you drive change because you don't close your mind to possibilities that you may not have thought of. It's not the word from above, it's a set of proposals that you need to think about. We hope that there will be a lot of discussion and debate, not for its own sake, but so that decisions can be taken. One of the issues we certainly would like is for Parliament, and not just this committee, but Parliament to be able to participate in this debate. Some of the authors will be with us. It's the 18th of June. And you know, we can arrange this, but it would be wonderful if through your office chair, Parliament can be invited into a seminar with some of the authors like Ricardo Hausmann and perhaps Danny and a few of the others, so that it's not a kind of secret discussion that we've had, because we'd like to take this forward into the broader South African society.
Thanks, Mark. I hope that it helps clarify issues for the committee as well. Okay, members, questions? Ms. Sibila, Dr. George, Mr. Maloto, Mr. Mare, Ms. Mokoto, Mr. Sim, Mr. Jackson, Babiko. Okay, in that order. Oh, Mr. Mkuni. Why didn't you just list all of them? okay, we're starting with Ms. Sibila.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have three questions to the Minister under Program 2 and 3. My first question, Chairperson, is on 2010 World Cup Program. I just want to ask the Minister as to what are fiscal implications of this program. My second question, Chair, is on development finance institutions. I want to ask the Minister if he's happy with the contribution that these institutions are making towards a realization of our development objectives. My last question, Chair, is under Program 3. I want to focus on the capital injection to Eskom. Minister, in your budget speech, you mentioned that this injection will not be a loan to Eskom. I just want to check what are the conditions that you have put in place for this injection. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair. My first question is to the Minister. In February, he mentioned the introduction of a poverty index. I was just wondering when that would be finalized. And then I have two questions for the DG. The first one is, the process of retirement fund reform, is that on track for implementation in 2010? And then, are you having difficulty in filling the vacant positions? Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Maloto.
Thank you. My first question is on inflation targeting. There is a view out there that maybe South Africa should shift the band, let's say from 4 to 8. Now, my question, Chair, is to what extent would that assist in containing inflation? Because I have a problem with that view, because it might, to my view, it might dent the credibility of the National Treasurer and the Reserve Bank. And to what extent would that also encourage people, whenever there is a spike in the inflation above 10, to continue to shift the band upwards? The other question linked to that is, I would assume that when you designed the target from 3 to 6, that when you designed the target from 3 to 6, you also checked the inflation rates of our trading partners. That influenced your thinking at one stage. Now, is it not prudent for us just to stick it out instead of discussing about shifting the bands? Because people believe that, sticking out would sort of instill credibility in our institutions. Linked to that, Chair, there's also a view that just accommodating inflation and not increasing interest rates would assist in lowering unemployment. But the challenge that we face in South Africa, that our unemployment is not cyclical, it's structural. What's your view on that? My other question, Chair, is on the non-performing loans in South Africa that are on the bank's books. Are you worried about them, or are they still within the manageable level? Chair, my other question, which is the last one, I just want to get the view of the minister and the national treasury. You know, we are there will be a new parliament in place next year. Now, I'm trying to look back and reflect, you know, because maybe because of my hairstyle, you tend to you tend to reflect on issues deeply. Yeah. Yeah. We had the collapse of some few small banks. Well, we had some boom. But now, I just want to find out, because I'm sitting with a problem here, that as Parliament, we never called the National Treasury to come and discuss that. What led to the collapse of Sambo and those other small banks? Now, I'm posing this question for the future Parliament and for National Treasury. Is it not time to start to discuss about developing protocols on how to engage on those type of issues? Because information that is being passed to the registrar by banks, some of it is very sensitive. I think it would be important for us to develop protocols to say, this is the type of information Parliament can have access to. And this is the other part that is very sensitive that we shouldn't open to the public, because that can undermine the trust between the registrar and the banks. I just want to hear your views on that, because as a new parliament, we might call, if anything happens, we might call the registrar and say, you bring every information that we require from you. And I think that might be problematic.
Can I request that we take responses to these questions, and then the first will be Ms. Mokoto on the next page of hers.
Chair, thanks for the questions. On Ms. Bidler's first question on the 2010, I'm going to ask Andrew Donaldson to deal with it in a moment. I'll run through the rest there. The second question on the development finance institutions, we've just concluded a pretty detailed study that evaluates. It's focused on, in the first instance, the big DFIs. That would be the DBSA, the IDC, the National Housing Finance Corporation, and the Land Bank. We've added the Independent Development Trust because it's still sitting on a pile of cash. And then there's a second tier of development finance institutions, including the National Empowerment NEF Fund, KULA, the APEX Fund, and MAFISA. So I think we have a reasonable understanding. We will start implementing the recommendations of this. An interministerial committee is being convened quite soon, en route to the development of a council that would take forward a system, because one of the key recommendations is these are kind of standalone. And development finance works better as a system. So what's happening in rural finance and agricultural finance matters in as much as what you're doing with industrial development. I think that amongst the issues that arise are trying to tighten the mandates, tighten the accountability, and then developing approaches to ensure better articulation between these DFIs. Also to look, I mean, the study looked at the assets, looked at the extent to which the scope for leveraging, etc., and all of those issues will be dealt with. Part of the difficulties, of course, are you want the system to work as a system, but understand that these are companies both with a statutory mandate individually, and also they are registered to the boards, have some responsibility. So it's working through that, but it's work in progress on the capital injection into ESCOM. I'm going to ask the DG to deal with that when he deals with some of the other questions. Dr. George's first question is on the poverty index. Now, I made a commitment that we would be through with the technical work. There's a slew of technical issues that have been worked at by Stats SA. And there's actually an amazingly rich literature on this area. There's been consultation with some of the people internationally who have been involved in the design of the systems. Professor Deaton what's that university? Princeton. Abhijit Banerjee, who's been involved in poverty measures, he's at the poverty lab at MIT. There really has been very, very extensive discussion. There are expectations in South Africa that are quite different. And the problem we're having at the moment is, do you take this technical work and put it into the domain and everybody shoots it down because, you know, there might be some views that say if you can't eat at a restaurant twice a month and if you can't get 5 movie tickets a month, you're poor. And if that be the impetus, then the work fails. So we're kind of stuck. I think Christians call it Armageddon. So, you know, Armageddon out of here, but, you know, we'll resolve these issues quite soon. But the problem is to try and I suppose, take out the hard politics and look at it as a technical measure. Aspirational, perhaps, but, you know, some people would want it at R1,000 and say, well, you're short by R800 on child support grants, you know. And then toy every day. I mean, you know, it's that kind of thing that we need to get past. So I'm saying there's a technical thing, but there's a harder set of political issues that we need to just get our heads around. Retirement fund reform and filling positions also arise from Dr. George. The inflation targeting band, I think we're responding in the same way. Again, there's a difficulty. There's a lot of detailed technical work being undertaken at the moment. On the one hand, you need an inflation target that speaks to the need to have price stability. That's not a nice to have, that's a constitutional imperative, as I said earlier. What is price stability? There's a view that says anything between 2 and 3%, but certainly it needs to take out price changes from any decision making, whether you are an investor or an employee. We've set the band. We took it on good advice. We were able to compare our systems, and I'm saying, you know, when we introduced the measure, a lot of technical work was done in the Treasury. So we had a fairly good sense of why we were doing it. I mean, it wasn't an accident. It wasn't to impose punishment. I think we understand the values that come from price stability. You may recall, Honorable Muloto, that initially, in the letter that I gave to the governor, there was an escape clause. There was an escape clause to deal with some of the circumstances we're dealing with at the moment. And then there was an intense round of discussion. You don't, every time you're under pressure, want to escape. I mean, if you have a watchdog at home, and the judges come to your house, you shoot the dog, because you don't want the dog anymore, you're going to be very vulnerable. How many times do you shoot the dog? Or do you shoot the dogs? So that clearly is an issue, and I think we would be on the same page with the Reserve Bank in saying, as a measure, in the peculiarities of South Africa, country with low savings, low reserves, as a measure, inflation targeting is without equal for now. It's the least worst of all the systems we've looked at. We clearly have to take a long view, because you can't say, well, we're targeting 3 to 6%, and then you are so far above it that the target doesn't have any credibility. It's like I used to try and play this game called golf on Google Auto. Now you stand on the tee box and there's a fairway, and the object of the exercise is to try and get the ball down the middle of the fairway. And every time you step onto the tee box, you hit the ball into the bush. Eventually, it's just not rational behavior anymore. So, I mean, we have to take the same view about inflation targeting. We want it to have credibility, because I think it's important that South Africans internalize this. Isn't that funny?
I was just wondering why you quit golf.
Now you know. I'm saying you're correct, the 3 to 6%. I mean, we didn't want this thing to be so tight. You know, there was a governor of a, can I mention the country, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, who overperformed on his target. Inflation was lower than the point, and he was dismissed. So, you know, we didn't want. Some people were saying in the analysis, 3 to 6%. I mean, that's a big range. But we think it's still a range worth fighting for. Part of what the slide showed, and part of what every bit of indication is at the present, is that inflation is now a global phenomenon. It's come out of a period of very, very low inflation that has its own attendant consequences. But inflation is now a global phenomenon. The third question you raised was about inflation and interest rates, and I think...
Sorry, Mr. Mgoni, what did you say? On inflation targeting. Maybe, whilst you're still at it, so that we don't go back to it. Yeah, go ahead, yeah? Can we allow him to follow that one up?
Chair, you chair the meeting. I serve at your behest.
Okay, so here's one point that I'm asking now, so that you don't have to go back to it. Using my push economics, my interpretation or my projection is that today the oil price is that in 13 months from March, the oil price will be $200. Simple projection. And also, seeing that we are moving towards ESCOM once the 50% increase tariffs, and increasing food prices, isn't the target that will be within the target, 63%, at the fourth quarter of 2009, a bit optimistic?
I suppose the first question I have to ask is, what is wrong with optimism? I know that economists are meant to be dismal and pessimistic, but what is wrong with optimism? But we can resolve that outside of your chat. I mean, the key question about the oil price is how much of it is structural and how much of it is speculative. You know, there's an interesting set of graphs that dates back the oil price index. I think it's probably 1895 or something like that through for just over a century, and it's a flat line around the $25 a barrel mark, with the two spikes of the Six-Day War and the Gulf War. But it's a kind of flat line. Now, working off that flat line, I mean, sure, it had dropped. 2001, it dropped to $11 a barrel. To move from there to a price north of $120 a barrel is probably not structural. Then you have to drill through, and it's not a very polite discussion to have. Then you have to drill through and evaluate what the supply constraints are. And again, you know, President Bush was in the Middle East just days ago and had discussions with Saudi King and so on and so on. They keep saying, and OPEC keeps saying, we can pump as much as you will have. They don't always do it, but they say it. So the extent to which there's a very real supply constraint is something that even former geologists need to apply their minds to. One of the issues in the slide deals with the conversion constraint from oil to fuel. Refining capacity is never just general, it's also determined by the quality of the crude available. And then there are the changing demand patterns. And even if you add in the most that China and India can add to cars, and even if you give every person in India a Tata Nano a few years down the line, even if you've done all of those things, you must be able to compute in what the supply changes are. And then you have to make certain assumptions about how much of a speculative bubble there is. Now, I could talk you through the same kind of discussion on food. Wheat, maize, soy, rice. Some things are going to be difficult. Rice, I mean, there are more people who eat rice, not just on Sundays. And then there are, I mean, rice wants a lot of water. And then you look at Burma or Myanmar, and you look at what's happened in the Delta there. And those rice paddies are going to be gone forever. So there are going to be changes, you know. I mean, so in the Philippines, there's a big campaign now to encourage Filipinos to eat maize instead of rice. So down the line, there's going to be probably a maize supply-demand constraint that arises. So these issues are going to be there. But with all of them, you know, if you've just lost your shirt in the dot-com bubble chair, and you sit down and take a view of different markets and you see what's coming down, you make certain assumptions about the oil market or agricultural futures, you punt your money on that, you know. If red doesn't pay, you punt your money on white, and perhaps, you know, this red thing is going to turn and your number is going to come up. I think that we can't discount certain speculative elements from price changes at the moment. Interesting thing is that probably, you know, give or take a few hours on either side of where we are now, parliaments across the world are discussing this issue. But let me conclude by saying that inflation is a rate of change. And if oil stays at $120 a barrel and it's still at that rate on the 20th of May 2009, it'll still be awfully expensive, but inflation on it would be zero. How you move then from 120 to 200, who is making the call and why, I think, is an important question. May I proceed to... I think on the inflation, interest rate, and jobs issue, the structural nature of our employment, it's a statement rather than a question that I want to agree with the Honourable Muloto on. On the non-performing loans, you know, some of these systems work because there is absolute trust. I digress and say there's Marie Michel, who heads up the Financial Intelligence Center. If they had to issue a press statement every time there's a suspicious transaction report, I would hazard the system starts working less well. Part of the discussion on the legislation is to get those other than the banks to behave with the same approach to compliance as the banks are behaving at the moment. That's a very important part of where we need to get to. But if you had to ask Mr. Kruger, the registrar of banks, to post all of the details that he gets on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, or on a monthly basis, because different information, on a website so that everybody knows, I would hazard that the compliance levels would drop very rapidly. So I say to people making these kinds of calls, just be very careful what you wish for. On the last question about the protocol, I think that it's a very necessary discussion to have. I take comfort, Chair, from the fact that you know, we're amongst the first countries to move to Basel II. And that we have... fewer unregulated institutions. And if you pause for a moment and look at the United States, former chair of the Fed had argued these are just bubbles on a steady stream. Actually, the bubbles appeared to be the stream. There were too many of them in the derivatives market, in hedge, in private equity, in the real estate market, and so on and so on, and the bubbles appeared to be the stream, and too much of it was unregulated. So the quality of regulation is going to be a very important issue, and I would accord with the view that the fourth parliament should set as one of its objectives trying to work through these protocols early, so that the quality of anticipation, degree degree of classification of information and the oversight of Parliament are given due attention. Thank you, Chair. Now, Gigi, do you want to...
Are you going to start with the DG or Andrew?
Briefly on the fiscal implications of 2010, the easy part of the answer is the spending side. As members of the committee will know that we added a further R1 billion this year to the national government's contribution for stadiums, bringing the total stadium contribution to R9.5 billion. There's about another R3.5 billion that is contributed mainly by cities and other sources. So a total stadium budget of close to R13 billion. There has just been a series of inspections of all the stadium projects. It was completed in October. Some are lagging a bit behind, some are lagging a bit more behind. But the projects are certainly well underway now, and that's five new stadiums and significant improvements to five others. There have been concerns raised about the cost escalations trend in these projects, and of course construction has been particularly affected by the inflation upturn in the last year or so. And there are three stadium projects where there are likely to be significant cost overruns. That's about half of the total spending. The transport projects are at least as important, and probably more important for their contribution to longer term infrastructure development. And there's similarly about nine billion or so from the national budget that has gone to the transport projects of the cities that will be hosting events in 2010. And progress there is a little harder to see because, of course, the projects are more diffuse, but I think all of us are already beginning to feel some of the inconvenience of some of the road projects that are underway, and work is near completion on the large procurement of buses that has to be undertaken by the Transport Department for 2010. There are also some fiscal implications on the communications infrastructure that are not completely finalized, but there's been good progress on that this year. So on the spending side, I think the sort of number that we're looking at is government spending of close to R20 billion in preparation for the event. But of course the fiscal implications of hosting a huge event that brings a lot of visitors to South Africa is much larger than that. If we and that's the more uncertain part of it, the substantial number of visitors to the economy, the boost to the economy associated with that, generates revenue that offsets for the economy at least part of the costs that have had to be committed. And then beyond 2010, there are important issues that the cities are beginning to have to deal with more systematically now about how these stadiums will be managed so that they can be sustainable without being a drain on cities' resources.
Of course, Andrew, the other important element of 2010 is the social security reform.
The costs of that are rather harder to quantify. The retirement reform and the broader social security reform project is not going to be a single event. It is a series of steps. Some of those steps have been taken already. In this year's budget, funding was set aside for some steps in the social assistance grants, equalizing the qualifying age for the old age grant for men and women. Some upward revisions in the means test threshold for social grants. So these are all important steps towards the social security reform project. Whether we will be ready by 2010 for the introduction of a contributory social security reform, that is quite a tough target, and given that there is legislation that would have to be completed, I think it's probably fair to say that we would hope to have the draft legislation in place and more detailed proposals for discussion in Parliament in the second half of the year, but it would be premature to make commitments on dates of implementation.
Thanks, Chair. There was a question about the capital injection to EFCOM. We said that it is not a grant. We didn't say that it is not a loan. It's not a grant. The underlying premise is still that EFCOM has to be funded by electricity users. We are cognizant, though, that the build program of EFCOM will put a pressure on a balance sheet, and that is why we said that we would like to support the EFCOM balance sheet with the 60 billion rand. We are still in negotiations with EFCOM as to the modalities of the 60 billion rand. The important thing here is that in whatever form that it takes, it should not undermine the balance sheet of EFCOM, so that they are able to execute the program that that has been set for them with respect to the built environment. There was a question from Dr. George about the filling of vacancies. I think that we have made a progress, but just as you fill the positions, there are people who identify opportunities going elsewhere. One of the most sought after things is somebody who has completed a National Treasury internship program. The National Treasury interns get grabbed so quickly. We're faced with an environment that you are working in a policy environment. Now, you do not find these people ready-made anywhere. And we then end up having to develop people internally. So we bring these people in as interns or as part of our talent pool, and we groom these people going forward. The feeling of post is never going to be easy. The labor markets are tight. Skilled people are hard to come by. You've got to pay up for it. Public service, you cannot quite pay up. But there is a different culture that is driving people working in the treasury, the passion to serve, the understanding that what we do impacts on the lives of ordinary people. And that was what keeps on this team going. Yes, there is many of them, if not all of them here, could walk into some high-paying job elsewhere. They have decided not to do it because
you
of...
You can say we, it's okay. You can say we.
No, I'm talking about them. I'm not talking about myself. I'm just an overhead, as I had said. there are the chaps who do the work, which we are only as good as what they do. Now, we come with a number of interventions. The internship program is one, where we bring in young people. When we launched the internship program, we thought that we would take people with B degrees. But then we found that there were people with honors degrees and others studying towards master's degrees applying to be part of the of our internship program. A lot of them we have managed to keep, but we have also lost others because of the aura that surrounds the treasury. There is also a feeling that anybody who is in the treasury must necessarily be very good, and they grab some of them when we still think that they are still being nurtured. They needed some time to go. The second program that we had embarked on had to do with the training of accountants. The treasury is now accredited as a top provider, a training outside a public practice. So we are now taking people into the treasury who either have completed or are about to complete the certificate in the theory of accounting, and we put them through the motions. It's a joint program with the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and we put these people through the motions, and then they could sit for the board exam and they can become the CAs, and our understanding is very clear that when they get their CAs, some of them will stay in the treasury, but the others should go to other government departments and even state-owned enterprises. And that's how we attempt to deal with that. But the labour markets are tight. It's not easy filling this position.
That's it on this page. I want to suggest that we break for tea for 10 minutes and come back and proceed. Yeah, 10 minutes. We come back here at exactly 20 minutes.